Welcome to the Wild Heart Meditation Center podcast. It is our intention to continue offering these audio recordings free of charge. However, if you would like to donate to support our cause and keeping our facility open in Nashville, you can do so via the Venmo app by sending a donation to @WildHeartNashville, or you can find us online at our website, wildheartmeditationcenter.org, and click the Donate tab. I wanted to talk a little bit about this topic of compassion, and the subtext here is the way through. You know, the Buddha talked about the path, the middle path, you know, the Dharma that he taught as a excavation, as a path really right into the middle of our lives, in a way to really investigate how suffering arises and where it arises from, and how to know its release. And so, you know, in a way, the path is like an uncovering of our innate natural ability to feel and to be with what arises in the present experience. You know, but so often when things arise into the present experience, the mind grabs hold of them and proliferates or ruminates or exaggerates and becomes reactive. And so the Buddha taught these four wise responses to, you know, what arises in our life, and they're called the Brahma-viharas. And the four Brahma-viharas are metta, or loving kindness, which he says is appropriate in all circumstances. And so no matter what arises into our awareness throughout the day, it's always appropriate to have a kind or gentle relationship to that experience. And we undertake these as trainings, right? So it's not about, you know, whether we naturally feel kind, or I call it the myth of authenticity. Sometimes we think we have to feel kind to practice kindness. But it's actually sometimes the other way around. You know, sometimes for myself, like, it spontaneously arises and I feel, you know, kind or gentle towards a thought or a feeling or a conversation or someone that I'm with, but oftentimes it's more of a training, it's a practice. And so he says metta is appropriate in every circumstance. And then there's a wise response to pain, which is compassion. And we don't actually need to practice compassion at all times. You know, I think that I value compassion, and this is something that we'll talk about. I think, you know, for many of us, it's a good idea. It's something we want to live by, but it's not always the appropriate response. But it is the appropriate response when we confront pain, or when we come into contact with difficulty, sorrow, grief, despair, loneliness, fear. And then there's the wise response to pleasant experiences. You know, experiences that are exciting or joyful, which is called mudita, or non-attached appreciation. Which again is hard, because when we enjoy something, we want it to stick around, we want to keep it together. But it's not always the case that that's what naturally arises. So we have to kind of practice taking active delight in something without attachment. And then the balancing factor of these Brahma-viharas is the final one, which is called equanimity, which is how we can use discernment or wisdom to meet the pain. That's the difference between, you know, falling into the despair or trying to fix the pain versus being able to hold it in a way that doesn't have as much attachment, or being able to appreciate something joyful without falling into craving or clinging around it. And so this is just a little bit of background for some of the folks that are maybe new to the practice. But I really wanted to talk about compassion itself as a wise response to pain, and some of the things that are said in the early discourses in early Buddhism about compassion. There's a really great book by a guy named Bhikkhu Anālio. He's a Buddhist scholar, and he lives at a place called Berry Center for Buddhist Studies in Massachusetts. And he's German by birth, But practiced in Sri Lanka for a long time and has been a monastic for probably like 20, maybe even 30 years. And he wrote a book called Compassion and Emptiness, and he talks about how in early Buddhism, in his study of the discourses, that they speak so much about the essential nature, the essential role of compassion and awakening and cultivating a skillful mind and skillful actions. But that they don't really offer a succinct definition for what compassion really is. And I think this is true for us in a lot of ways, that like we know what compassion feels like. We've had moments where people have been compassionate with us, or where compassion's kind of naturally been felt. And it is a principle we want to live by, but it's really hard to kind of wrap our mind around what exactly compassion is. So it's more than just a word that we value. It's not really a definition we seek to understand. It's an intention and a view that we wish to cultivate. So compassion is an aspiration for all beings to be free from suffering. And it's a view. Right? But it's also seems to have this kind of organic intelligence to it. Right? It also seems to feel embodied. And there are some qualities to it that I want to talk about today. But first, I want to read a sutta from the early Buddhist discourses where the Buddha talks about, he describes someone that has compassion in their mind and their heart. And so this is really cool because this is how the Buddha kind of got around using definitions, was using a lot of similes and metaphor. And so he describes in the sutta, really, it's actually what he's talking about is how someone can overcome resentment. And so if you're resentful towards someone, he says, this is what you should kind of do, is act as if you were this onlooker here in this story. So he says, let me get both of these up here. He says, it is just like a person who is on an extended journey along a long road. Becoming sick halfway, he is exhausted and suffering extremely. He is alone and without a companion. The village behind is far away, and he has not yet reached the village ahead. Suppose a person comes and, standing to one side, sees that this traveler on an extended journey along a long road has become sick halfway, is exhausted and suffering extremely. He's alone and without a companion. The village behind is far away, and he has not yet reached the village ahead. The second person, the onlooker, then would think, if I were to get him an attendant, emerge from being in the wilderness far away and reach a village or town, and if he were to be given excellent medicine and be fed with nourishing and delicious food, be well cared for, then in this way the person's sickness would certainly subside. So that person, the onlooker, has extremely compassionate, sympathetic, and kind thoughts in the mind towards the sick person. And so I was actually talking to my wife recently about resentment and, you know, how hard it is to really look at the context of the person that we're angry at, you know, and how so much of our freedom from suffering comes from re-examining how we perceive someone. And I often say when we meet in person, you know, if we were to just spend this entire time getting to know one another and really seeing the full breadth of our lived experience, everything that we've been through, you know, I think that the heart naturally softens when we have understanding and when we can see more clearly who we are talking to, you know, not just the symptom, right, of someone's behavior, but really the personal experience. And so I just want to read this part again. He says, this is what the onlooker thinks to himself, that the Buddha describes as compassionate thoughts. If he were to get an attendant, emerge from being in the wilderness far away and reach a village or town, and were to be given excellent medicine and be fed with nourishing and delicious food, be well cared for, then in this way this person's sickness would certainly subside. And there are four things that are different aspects of compassion, I think, are mirrored here in the sutta. One is understanding. So this is someone that has the willingness to kind of look on. And I like that it says the onlooker is standing to the side. So this is another part of compassion, which is equanimity, to not get consumed in the pain or the despair. So there's understanding, there's equanimity, there's also empathy, which is an ability to feel, right? The onlooker here understands what it might feel like to be alone, right? To not have a companion, as he says. So there's understanding, there's empathy, there's equanimity, and then there's this final thing, which in Buddhism is true compassion, which is the aspiration for all beings to be free from suffering. It's a wish, you know, it's a aspirational wish to alleviate the suffering that we see in the world. And so this is what I would call the path through compassion. And it starts with understanding. And the Buddha talks about this in his teaching in the First Noble Truth, that in order to develop one's understanding of suffering, we have to be willing to turn towards it and not shy away from it. In Pali Sanskrit, the term for this is dukkha parinya, which means to fully know dukkha. And dukkha, for those that are new, is this kind of this term that was actually etymologically, it's linked to the wheel well of an ox cart wheel. And when the axle doesn't fit quite right into the center of the wheel well. And so there's always this kind of disjointedness or vulnerability to this human existence. And to some degree, we have to come to terms with the inherent vulnerability of our condition, right? That we often feel, I think, that the difficult or painful or uncertain experiences in our life should be otherwise, that it shouldn't be this way. And what the Buddha's doing is he's saying something very radical, but very, I think, realistic, which is, who says it shouldn't be this way? This is the way that it is. Birth, aging, sickness, death, separation, loss. They're a part of the fiber of our human condition, and that it's actually in embracing the truth and the reality of that, that we feel less alone in it. You know, to fully know dukkha means, I think, to realize our human condition. To realize our human condition means to realize that we're not alone. And so this is really the foundation or the seed for compassion. When we're willing to turn towards what's difficult, when we're willing to open ourselves and embrace some of those uncertain emotions, we feel a lot more connected. And there's this kind of like backwards law that Alan Watts calls it, which is oftentimes when we desire something to be positive or pleasant when it's not, it in and of itself is a negative experience. But when we accept a negative experience or something difficult or sorrowful, that it in and of itself is a positive experience. And there seems to be this kind of backwards relationship. I know for myself, at least, it feels very counterintuitive when I'm sad to just sit with my sadness. You know, when I'm scared to just sit with my fear. And I'll tell you, like, my mind will go to every other house on the block before it says, just sit with it and see what happens. You know? So I think it's important to have some humility with the First Noble Truth and this first aspect of compassion, which is understanding. It's hard to turn towards our pain and suffering and to seek to try to understand it rather than fix it. So I want to read along these lines of understanding a quote by the Bodhisattva Mr. Rogers. My wife actually shared this with me the other day, and it's just been kind of ringing through my mind. I'd heard it before, but it was incredibly powerful for, you know, what's been going on right now. He says, anything that's human is mentionable, and anything that is mentionable can become more manageable. When we talk about our feelings, they become less overwhelming and less upsetting. Anything that is human is mentionable, and anything that is mentionable can become more manageable. You know, for me, you know, here lately, it's like all of these subtle feelings that I've been dealing with. You know, if I'm talking about compassion, there's been a lot of joy in my life. There's been a lot of peace in my life. Like I was talking to someone earlier, I've really been liking the slower pace of things. But if I'm looking at what's been difficult for me, you know, it's been like loneliness. It's been fear and uncertainty. You know, it's been restlessness and dealing with just like a mind that wants to be more active. And it's really hard to, you know, to talk about some of these subtle things, especially when there are other people that are suffering so greatly right now. You know, but I think it's important that we don't get lost in this thing that I've heard called comparative suffering, where it's like, well, if someone's suffering worse than I am, I can't feel my pain or difficulty. You know, we feel like I should be grateful, right? Again, these expectations can come in. And while I think it's true to help ground ourselves in, like, you know, looking at the full range of our experience and that there are many things to be grateful for, I think it's also important, at least for myself lately, to, you know, being human, anything that's human is mentionable. Anything that I'm experiencing is worth giving attention to. And so, you know, in recovery language, they talk about pain shared is pain lessened, right? And so when we're able to mention and become honest about and recognize what's been hard for us, you know, and we're willing to share it, there's no longer that personal sense of self that constructs or constellates around our pain that makes me feel alone in it. For me, I feel a lot more compounding to my suffering when I feel like it's mine, when I feel like it's me, you know, when I feel like it's something that I did. And so pain shared is pain lessened. All right. It feels weird just talking to the computer. Hopefully some of this is stirring some things up in your own mind, because I want to hear some discussion afterwards. So I want to also talk about empathy and equanimity, which are the next two aspects of compassion. So once we're able to stop and recognize or sit with what's difficult, to turn towards it, or as the Buddha says, to fully know dukkha, you know, it's important that we actually allow ourselves to feel with what's difficult. And this is really the basis of what empathy is. It's probably the most misunderstood aspect of compassion. I think a lot of times empathy gets mistaken for compassion itself. Empathy means to feel with. It's this, you know, I see you and I feel you. I'm willing to feel and resonate with what's difficult. And I mean, it's very natural to our human brain. Like when we see someone in pain or seeing someone suffering, we may turn away out of aversion or feeling overwhelmed. But I think the reason why we have aversion or get overwhelmed is because at the base, we already care. You know, we naturally care when we see pain. You see, you know, you can even, when you see someone else stub their toe, it's like, shit, my toe, you know, like you feel the pain of that. And I notice this so much with having a daughter, right? It's like, she has like three levels of cry. There's like, just like her self-soothing cry, which is very low grade. There's like normal baby cry, and there's like level three, like, you know, horrible cry. And when she gets to that third level, everything inside of me is just feeling that emotion, you know, and I want nothing more than to soothe her, to calm her down. And I can't always do that right away, you know? So empathy is just this kind of like, how can I feel with this experience? And this is really hard. I mean, but this is definitely something we develop through meditation. You know, by sitting with the discomfort that arises, by sitting with the restless mind, by sitting with, you know, whatever comes into the present experience and acknowledging it and saying, I'm here with you. I'm not you. I'm not going to get consumed by you, but I'm here with you, mind. I'm here with you, body. I'm here with you, feelings. And so it really opens our window of tolerance to hold. And so empathy needs to be, well, I'll say one thing. Our understanding of something becomes clarified as we're able to put ourselves in touch with how it feels. So I can recognize suffering or that something's going on in my life, but not really take the time to sit with it and feel it. You know what I'm saying? Like, I can recognize that someone else is struggling, and we don't always have the time, but I can often not take the time to sit with them and to be in that experience with them. So understanding, empathy, and then equanimity. So can I feel with or feel this pain or difficulty without becoming lost in what I feel? You know, of course, this is hard to do, but again, meditation can help us to not get lost in despair or pity. And they call these the near enemies of compassion. Oftentimes when I think that I have compassion, I'm actually in pity or, you know, or I'm overwhelmed with despair. And I may have understanding, I may have empathy, but I don't have much equanimity in those moments. You know, which is where the Buddha says in the sutta, this onlooker standing to one side, you know, stepping back and recognizing that, you know, we can't always fix or solve dukkha. Often in our attempts to try to fix or solve the dissatisfaction, the dis-ease, the suffering in our lives, we just create reactivity. We fight against reality, right? Byron Katie says, I'm not a spiritual person because I like spirituality, but because it hurts like hell to argue with what is, you know? And when we try to fix or control, or we get lost in the emotion of the pain, a lot of times we're not really well resourced. And so part of our practice, and this is really hard, is trying to stand on our own two feet in the midst of the pain or loneliness or fear. You know, this is here, but not falling into the trance of the emotion, the story of what it's telling me, or I'm here with you, but I don't need to fix you. You know, I can be present and that's enough. And we'll talk about that here in a little bit, that caring is enough. And this kind of gets to the next part, which is the aspiration for freedom. This is really in Buddhism what compassion is mostly linked to, which is a wish for all beings to be free from suffering. That all we can do is oftentimes care and carry that intention into our lives. It's a concern for others to have relief, you know, and ourselves to have relief. It's a wish for freedom. You know, so I actually think, you know, in what I've been told through reading Bhikkhu Nalio's book is that compassion should have some hopefulness, some optimism. It should take freedom as the object of its reflection. Right? And so I want to talk about this because this is very subtle. I can turn towards what's difficult. I can feel what's difficult. I can step aside from it and acknowledge it. But I also want to have this hopeful intention that there's maybe a path to freedom. You know, that I want to wish well. You know, I want to have a hopeful optimism, as Howard Zinn calls it. And so I want to read this quote real quick and then talk about the practice itself. We can have some discussion. Howard Zinn wrote, "To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, and kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there are so many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending the spinning top of a world in a different direction. And if we do act, in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of present moments, and to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory." And so I've been reflecting on this a lot lately. I don't know if it was like the change of the decade or then having the tornado come through Nashville and then now having, you know, all been under social isolation for a few weeks. But I really like that he says to be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It's based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, and kindness. And he says what we choose to emphasize. Where does he say it? What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. And so this is the, you know, this is the aspect of compassion that takes freedom as the object of its view. And, you know, so I'm interested in bringing this more into experience, right? So this is kind of like what is involved in compassion, understanding a willingness to turn towards and be honest about where we suffer, a willingness to feel with whatever the difficulty is that arises. It's an equanimity to not get consumed in despair or pity or some of the stories that kind of keep us stuck in drowning in those painful feelings. And a hopeful optimism that we can find a way out. Not always right away, not always as a way to fix it, but as a way to wish ourselves well and wish others well.